I consider the true history of the American Revolution as lost. Pastor John started down that road with us last Sunday. He talked a lot about rediscovering God in America. And I thought that this movie clip was rather revealing. Number one, just to know a little bit about John Adams' personality. But more so in the fact that we struggle with putting real men in real places as sinful and as real as they were. But the fact that it was already taking place within John Adams' lifetime, that they had taken these people and sort of marbleized them, turned them into statues and pretty paintings to hang on the wall, and that the reality of what they went through in that war, scurrying in about to put their signature on Mr. Jefferson's parchment, as he says, was very real and very scary. But what we're talking about over a six-week time period in particular is the fact that as that revisionist history has been written, that we've taken God out of it at the same time. As I said, Pastor John talked about it last week, and I remember the last time I was in Washington, D.C. It was very vivid to me because I happened to be there at the time of Ronald Reagan's funeral. But what I remember as vividly as that funeral was going around to the monuments, and as we saw each monument and visited it, first you're kind of awestruck by the, you know, Lincoln and Washington and Jefferson and their grand marble figures. But after that, you kind of stop and read some of the inscriptions on the sides of the monuments. And you start to discover and realize, as you read their quotes and their most famous and favorite writings and things that they read and asked to be put in their memories, that they were very religious and very centered on Christ in their lives. And that's what we're spending 6 weeks to talk about. What I want to talk about today is our declaration of interdependence. And when I tried to do this at 8:30 this morning, I really struggled with the interdependence, so if I keep saying independence, you'll forgive me. But, you know, we use the term freedom quite liberally during the holidays like this one. It's sprinkled all over our Founding Fathers' documents, such as the Declaration of Independence and particularly the Bill of Rights, freedom of speech, freedom of liberty, and so forth. But freedom to do what? Our Founding Fathers were wise enough and knew God well enough to know that freedom to do whatever we pleased, to pursue our earthly desires, would simply change the identity of our slave master. We would go from being enslaved by a European king to a new enslavement in sin. The interdependence that I'm talking about causes us to rely on God and, in essence, live the opposite of following our sinful desires, living Christ-like. It's interesting that every time John asked me to come in here and substitute preach so he could take a day off, by happenstance, I always seem to be in the middle of a good book where there's something that God's tapping me on the shoulder and saying, "Here it is, Dave. You don't need to sweat it too much. I gave it to you already." And the one that my small group's working on right now is called The Mind of Christ, written by a guy by the name of T.W. Hunt. And what he really does is take Jesus' life apart and his direct quotes and break it down and help us to understand as humans who Jesus was. And if you really read and study the continuity of what he said in his perfection of a life, he really helps you break that down. And one of the things that I noticed as I was kind of trying to pull this message together today is that there are a lot of Christ-like qualities that we have adapted as a country. And they basically enabled this interdependence that I'm talking about. If our country could but cast aside the sin that took down other great empires, Greece and Rome and the great empires of medieval England and later, that we could be something more. We could be great. We could be free. We could show so much of the world what's possible if only we would adapt Christ-like qualities. So what I tried to do for this morning was to pick out five Christ-like qualities that I think at times when we are at our best, our country has adopted, and how that helped us to become what we are. And if we but adopt it too, allow us to be interdependent on Christ and really live out our freedom the way that we would want to. The first Christ-like quality I already touched on, it's freedom. Galatians 5, verse 1 through 15 says, "It is for freedom that Christ set us free. Stand firm then, and do not let yourselves be burdened again by a yoke of slavery. You, my brothers, were called to be free." Almost sounds like one of the founding fathers, doesn't it? "But do not use your freedom to indulge the sinful nature. Rather, serve one another in love. The entire law is summed up in a single command. Love your neighbor as yourself. If you keep on biting and devouring each other, watch out, or you will be destroyed by each other." I thought it was so good that after I read it and put it in my sermon notes, I looked at my study Bible. I just pulled it out and I said, I wonder what it says about, you know, Galatians 5. It said, "Christ died to set us free from sin and from a long list of laws and regulations." You know, you had the Pharisees and the Sadducees in Jesus' time. And then the colonials of 1776 that lived here were living under the laws and regulations of Great Britain and were trying to cast themselves free of that. Christ came to set us free, not to do whatever we want, because that would lead us back into slavery to our selfish desires. That's where we could have gone as a country. Rather, thanks to Christ, we are now free and able to do what was impossible before, to live unselfishly. We're going to talk about that. Those who appeal to their freedom so that they can have their own way or indulge their own desires are falling back into sin. The first Christ-like quality that we took on as a country, obviously, when that document was signed, was freedom. The second one that I thought was every bit as interesting was humility. In Ephesians 4, it's written, "As a prisoner for the Lord, then I urge you to live a life worthy of the calling you have received. Be completely humble and gentle. Be patient, bearing with one another love. Make every effort to keep the unity of the Spirit through the bonds of peace." You know, if you really think about how different the United States of America was after it was formed in 1776, you only have to look back to the European governments that it spawned from. These were kingdoms run by kings and divided up into lordships and fiefdoms that were given. Power was handed out to the rich and powerful to exchange wealth and power from among each other. But if you think about after Washington and Adams and Jefferson, who really helped forge this country after that? I remember hearing something and learning something in high school history, and I won't get it exactly right, but something about from the time of Andrew Jackson past Lincoln, to be president of the United States, you had to be born in a log cabin. These were not wealthy lords that passed their lordships and their wealth back and forth to each other. We came to be a Christ-like country by being led by the humble. I remember reading David McCullough's rendering of Harry Truman. It's fascinating if you ever have time to burn through about 700 pages. It's just fantastic. But Truman was one of these guys. He was a backwoods Missouri senator. And the whole reason he was picked was because the Democratic Convention at the time would have been in the mid-40s, I can't remember the year, but they were looking for somebody that wasn't going to rattle anybody, that wasn't going to cause any stir, wasn't going to be a pompous FDR-type person. They wanted somebody to live in FDR's shadow that would just be told what to do. And so they picked a humble man from Missouri and stuck him in there because he would be quiet and sit in the back. Well, guess what? A couple years later, FDR is dead. World War II is raging on. And we've got real problems. As a country, we've been led by the humble. Go one layer deeper into our history. How this country was really built and formed. Think about the immigrants that came through Ellis Island. Think about the Irish and Chinese laborers that built the Transcontinental Railroad. Think about the treasury agents that toiled quietly in fear of death that took down Al Capone and the gangsters of Chicago in the 30s. These were not great lords with great wealth. They were humble people. Just as Jesus exhorts us to be, that found a moment and shaped our country as a humble country. Sacrifice. If there was one thing that Jesus was identified with, it was sacrifice. His entire existence was there. If you think about it, we called Him the Lamb of God even before He was born. Why? Because the lambs were slaughtered in the temple, in the Jewish temples in the Old Testament time as a sacrifice to God. And Jesus was for once and for all to become the ultimate sacrifice. This book by Hunt that I talked about, The Mind of Christ, I don't think I could say it any better than he did, so I'll just read it to you. Jesus' life was a life of sacrifice, of self-giving. He made Himself of no reputation, as in Philippians 2. The Master who created the universe continued in subjection to His earthly parents, as in Luke 2:51. He temporarily sacrificed authority. He who was king above all kings became an itinerant preacher. He sacrificed nobility. The wonder worker who fed thousands gave up food to concentrate on His Father's will. He sacrificed bodily satisfaction. He sacrificed heaven to come to us. If love is self-giving, then Jesus is love. No greater example in the entire history of sacrifice than Jesus Christ. Is it a Christ-like quality that we've taken on as a country? Okay, I'm going to take you back to history class. The last sentence of the Declaration of Independence. Wes is giving me the look, he knows it. To this we pledge our lives, our fortunes, and our sacred honor. Because they knew. And the Revolution was probably almost lost 5 times just in the few months after signing the Declaration, as Washington's army was battered about from New York to New Jersey to on and off and became almost not an army at times. They knew if it failed, at the very least they would be strung up as traitors, have everything taken away from them. The Founding Fathers, although it's not quite like it was painted, as they signed that document, knew what they were in for. But, I mean, really, if you think back to our history and some of the great military campaigns, just like our leaders, our great generals were not necessarily wealthy, power-driven people who were conquesting territory for their own betterment. Most of the great campaigns we ever fought were fought with military made up of volunteer armies, right? My poor wife, Amber, over the last couple months when the HBO series The Pacific was on, I made her watch it with me. And you sit there and watch them take Guadalcanal and Iwo Jima and Okinawa, all with volunteers. And all of the military campaigns, most of them in our history you can think of, were stories of sacrifice by everyday soldiers. And I couldn't think of anything much better than the story of the Battle of Cold Harbor, which isn't one of the famous battles like Gettysburg, but it's one that always sticks in my mind. Because it was very like a lot of the battles that were fought in the Civil War. The Union Army is chasing Lee and chasing Lee and chasing Lee. And Lee got to the high ground first, stationed his artillery at the top of that mountain. And Grant marched all of his troops down to the bottom of the mountain at night when the sun was going down, and they built their campfires and they knew what was coming. Many of the troops stopped, wrote their names on pieces of paper and sewed them to the backs of their jackets. They knew what was coming the next day. We are a nation of sacrifice. Are we a peaceable nation? That was the fourth one I came up with. James 3:18 says, "Peacemakers who sow in peace raise a harvest of righteousness." You know, after we invaded Iraq in 2001, there's a lot of people that talked about, are we peaceable or not? But I kind of took myself back in my mind to, I lived in England in 1992 for a while. And I remember being there, and I remember this was right when the Balkans War first broke out. Yugoslavia was breaking apart. And I'm sitting there and I'm watching this happen, and it gets a lot of coverage because I was only 1,000 miles away from there or so forth, living in London. And I'm watching the BBC, and they keep talking about this war that's breaking out, and Yugoslavia is coming apart, and there's ethnic strife, and there's fighting, and guns going off, and I'm watching it, and I'm going, there's all these huge European countries there, Britain and France and Germany and Italy and Greece, and they all have big economies and big militaries. And every time one of their prime ministers or their trade ministers or somebody would be interviewed, what would they say? They would say, we need the Americans to step in. We were the only people that could bring peace to that area. A little more minor and more humorous story I can think of is I just ran across it when I was on vacation, read a book over March. It was called The Parsley Crisis of 2002. And there's this tiny little island in the Straits of Gibraltar between Morocco and Spain. And there's nothing there literally but a couple of parsley fields and some wild sheep. Nobody lives there. But it historically had it sort of been disagreed upon between Morocco and Spain who owned it. So one day in 2002, the Spanish Navy stops there, puts the flag up, says it's Spain's. And of course, Morocco doesn't like this, so they're getting their military all geared up, and we're going to go to have a fight, right? There's going to be a war break out over this little island with a parsley field on it in the middle of the Straits of Gibraltar. The European Union is around. Did anybody call them? No. Did anybody call the United Nations? No. Did anybody call Britain or France or Germany or Spain or, well, Spain was in it, but anybody else around there? No. Poor Colin Powell, the Secretary of State of the United States of America, 5,000 miles away, was trying to go swimming with his grandkids, and he took half the weekend shuttling faxes and emails and phone calls halfway across the world to settle the parsley crisis of 2002. Because, as America, we were the only ones that could bring peace. The last Christ-like quality I thought I'd talk about this morning was what I call, and I'm not trying to be too flowery here, but the acceptance of divine providence. And what is that? Well, we all remember Jesus' words at Gethsemane, right? He's knelt over in the Garden of Gethsemane. His face is sweating blood, and he asks if this cup be taken from him. But we know the words after that, not my will, but thine be done. I like it just as well the way he said it in John 5:19. The Son can do nothing by himself. He can do only what he sees his Father doing. Because whatever the Father does, the Son also does. If you read through all of the private letters that Adams and Jefferson and Washington wrote at the time, their trust in divine providence was very close to that of Jesus. They're being whipped up and down the countryside by the British Army, and they know that times are tough. And they don't know if they're going to win or not, but the one thing they do know is that they trust God. And whatever happens, it was God's will for this country to happen the way it did. But I don't know anybody that could say it any better than Abraham Lincoln, and I apologize I had to put so many words in your sermon notes. But if you want to talk about divine providence, about that acceptance of God's will for our country, I don't know anybody that could have done it better than when Lincoln wrote his second inaugural. And you think about the time and the place. We were 4 years into the most brutal, bloody war that we've ever fought as a country. The nation had literally almost split in two hundreds of times over the past 4 years, and Lincoln had overseen it all. He was mentally, emotionally, physically, completely exhausted. But the one thing that he knew, and he began to understand as he wrote the speech, was that God's will was coming down on the country and that we were paying for slavery. So he's talking about the Confederacy and the Union and how we each pray one against the other. And he said, both read the same Bible and pray to the same God, and each invokes his aid against the other. It may seem strange that men should dare to ask a just God's assistance in wringing their bread from the sweat of other men's faces. But let us judge not that we be judged. The prayers of both could not be answered. That of neither has been answered fully. The Almighty has His own purposes. Finally, do we hope, fervently do we pray, that this mighty scourge of war may be speedily pass away. Yet if God wills that it continue until all the wealth piled up by the bondsman's 250 years of unrequited toil, he's talking about slavery there, shall be sunk, and until every drop of blood drawn with the lash shall be paid in the Netherlands by the sword, as was said 3,000 years ago, still it must be said. The judgment of the Lord are true and righteous altogether. End quote. We're a nation founded on freedom that God calls for every one of His children to have. Independence Day celebrates our freedom to pursue life, liberty, and happiness. And yeah, I'm sorry I didn't call the band up. Not as good as John at that. God is the one true source of freedom and is the one who gives us life, freedom, and happiness. Because of that, we do not declare our independence from Him. But because we are free, we declare our interdependence on Him. I hope you have a wonderful holiday. But I also hope you remember the Christ-like qualities that we've taken on as a country. And as we move forward, let's remember that in the midst of all of our picnics and barbecues and fireworks. And enjoy the time that John spends with you over the next 4 or 5 weeks to really learn and understand what that means. Thanks for your time. We all have freedom that was purchased by those that came before us through blood, sweat, and toil. Are you using it to pursue your sinful desires? Or are you building an interdependence on God? Thanks. Have a wonderful weekend. Enjoy this beautiful weather. Thanks. Amen.